Welcome to the Sticks and Stones podcast, bringing you interviews with people from across the globe who are changing the face of sexual health for the better. This is the place to hear about new approaches and initiatives in sexual health, best practice, challenges, and to meet some of the people who are driving change from around the world. My name is Nick Mellon, and I administer the SDI International Exchange, or STICS. I hope you enjoy today's conversation, and please subscribe to receive future episodes.
Today, we've got a really insightful interview with Dr. Patricia Kissinger, who is an infectious disease epidemiologist and associate dean at Tulane University at their School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine down in sunny New Orleans. We hope you enjoy this episode and do look out for more episodes to come. So hi, Paddy, and welcome. Wonderful to have you on the Sticks and Stones podcast. Just to begin with, tell me how you got into sexual health and how you're here today as the Professor of Epidemiology at Tulane University in New Orleans.
Well, thanks, Nick. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very flattered to be a part of this. So I got into sexual health many years ago. So I first started as a nurse. I was a pediatric nurse, and then I went into Peace Corps in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I just noted infectious disease was, I was so interested in infectious diseases. So I went back to Tulane and got my master's, and then I felt like I still needed to learn more. So I got my PhD. And so when I got my PhD, I went to Haiti to work in Cité Soleil to look at a HIV maternal child transmission study. And so I was thought, well, I was going to work exclusively in HIV, but then I got back to New Orleans and my wonderful mentor, David Martin, said, hey, you need to start looking at STIs too. And I said, oh, wow, okay. So then I started getting very involved in STIs and looking mostly, my early work was with chlamydia and I still work with chlamydia. And then again, another like sort of an informal mentor, Dr. Ned Hook, wrote an editorial about Trichomonas vaginalis. And he said, why isn't anybody interested in it? And I said, well, I'm interested in that. So then I started to write grants. I was working at this HIV clinic. And so there was all sorts of data available to me. And I started to look at STIs and HIV infected people. And then I started to move on to STIs in just the general population.
And it sounds like that Peace Corps mission out to the Democratic Republic of Congo really sort of changed you and changed your focus. Tell me a bit more about that.
Well, so, you know, when I was working in the ICU, pediatric ICU, we would use like four nurses working on one baby, and we'd go through like bags and bags of equipment. And then I went to Democratic Republic of Congo and we had like 14 needles for like hundreds of kids. So I'm like, there's so many disparities and inequities in HIV and STIs in general that I really felt like that was my calling to really, you know, I've always been interested in sort of helping out people that don't have resources. And so that's where it just really hit me that this is what I want to do. And when I was there in Democratic Republic of Congo, because it was in the early 80s, you know, the whole HIV epidemic was evolving and we were still calling it Slim's disease. We didn't really even know what it was. And then when it became obvious that it was HIV, then I started to get more interested in it. And I, you know, I just saw that excellent people in infectious diseases were working in HIV and then a lot of them also other STIs. So I was looking towards, you know, being part of that club, maybe.
And how did you find that pivot, Paddy, from HIV into wider STIs? Because I think in Europe, we see it, you know, sort of much more integrated than in the US, where there's separate budgets, separate departments. How did you manage to sort of get the two to converge?
As you state, in the United States, all of the money goes to HIV. Very little goes to STIs. And you know, the people at NIH and CDC are trying to work with that, but it just doesn't get as much attention as HIV. So there is always that you're vying for a smaller pot of funds. And so you just have to be more competitive for it. So that was the pivoting towards this sort of abundance in funding for HIV to STIs. I kind of used it and I said, well, I'm looking at how STIs influence HIV. So that was one of the angles I took for a long time. Now, the problem is well, not the problem. It's a wonderful problem to have, is now we have PrEP. And so the field of STIs in HIV-infected people has changed. So now where people are less, you know, the general population is less interested in STIs, they're more interested in getting PrEP and preventing HIV. So it is still, I haven't fully pivoted. I'm still trying to figure out how we can get people to be interested in some of the other STIs that cause a great deal of, you know, syphilis is huge right now, particularly in the United States. And I know elsewhere, really on worldwide, it's a problem, but it's increased like 80%. And congenital syphilis just shouldn't exist. And yet we have a lot of congenital syphilis. So I just really feel like that, you know, just keeping that on the fore, keeping it in people's minds and making sure that people understand how important it is really important.
So it sounds like sort of still using HIV as the foundation, but bringing in the other the STIs to show the links and how they're working, and then use that as a way of promoting and pushing the focus on the STIs in themselves.
And also, for a long time, I've really loved working with adolescents. I think they're hilarious. They're so cute. They have a lot of special needs that I think people don't really always consider. They're disenfranchised because they can't vote, really, and they don't have a loud voice. And what self-respecting adolescent is going to talk about STDs? They just don't talk about it. So I do love that. I love working with groups that have been traditionally sort of marginalized and have not been considered. And so that's another thing that kind of gets me jazzed and gets me interested in continuing with this work.
Yeah, no, I share your interest in adolescents. I've got two myself. So my interest in them is not reciprocated by their interest in me.
It never is.
So tell me about some of the projects that you've done. You mentioned, you know, the adolescents and the underserved populations. What sort of tangibly are you doing to try and engage or work with those populations?
Well, so my 35-year career, I've done a lot of things, but one of the most recent ones is trying to use the home test. There's a proliferation of home testing. People are doing it. And the problem is you can't just have a home test program without stimulating the interest in the population. And so we did a thing called Check It, which was a way of getting young African-American men specifically tested for chlamydia. Men were not considered. They're not in the recommendations, you know, unless they're in a high prevalence area. Well, anybody in the area I work in New Orleans is in a high prevalence area. So we were trying to get them to do home testing. And then if they were positive, we would mail them their medication for them and their partners. So this was something that was kind of, you know, it's still kind of novel to bundle all of these evidence-based interventions into one. And so that's what we did. And so we're waiting to see if we'll get that renewed so that we can continue on. And it was interesting, as we were looking at all the men, we thought women were fine because they're supposed to get screened. And then we realized that the women weren't getting screened either. And so we decided to add in women into this equation. So we'll see if NIH likes it. And the other thing I've been long interested in is Trichomonas vaginalis. I worked on the CDC treatment guidelines with my very close colleague, Christina Musney, Kim Workowski, and others. And so Trichomonas vaginalis is a neglected parasitic STI that's been around forever. The medication has never been really excellent. We have a lot of breakthrough with it. So I am now working, Christina Musney and I and some others are working on a randomized trial to examine better medications. And really the medication, we don't know anything about treatment of Trichomonas in men. There's been very few studies in men. So we want to know, do we care about Trichomonas in men? Are they really the reservoir for women, or do they just spontaneously clear? And so we want to see if we need to get, you know, do they need secnidazole or tinidazole, or is metronidazole 2 gram just sufficient for them? Because if that is, that's a lot cheaper. So we're just trying to look at the cost effectiveness of it and which medications are better by sex. And we do think there might be some sex differences.
That's so interesting. And, you know, given it's the highest or the most common STI in the US, it just doesn't get the awareness, does it, of some of the other infections? And it's even worse in some other countries.
We don't really know as much as we should know about asymptomatic Trichomonas. We know a lot about symptomatic, but we don't know as much about asymptomatic. So if we start to screen all these people, is it important to treat them? You know, it's sort of the question like chlamydia. You know, you screen all these people and it should we treat all of them? Because are we promoting antimicrobial resistance? So these are questions that, my colleagues and I are really interested in answering.
Tell me a little bit about your present role at Tulane. Paddy, what does sort of your day-to-day involve? How is your work structured around that?
Well, so I am Associate Dean of Faculty Affairs, so about 25% of my time is putting out fires. But then the rest of it really is teaching and writing grants and conducting grants. So I do teach two courses. One is called Epidemiology of Sexual Health. And the undergrads, I bring them because they're kind of near peers. So I bring them out into high schools and middle schools, and they teach STI. So it's for me to show them how to teach, and then they go ahead and teach. And I'm really proud to say that I've had about 3 or 4 students actually go into the field. And so for me, that's a really big coup that they thought it was interesting enough. And whenever we can get young people on sexually transmitted infection research or anything having to do with it, it's really great, because I think, you know, we need to replenish the group of researchers that are, you know, aging like me. We need youngins in there to give us the right. And we have different things that we're going to have to deal with. AI is one of them. You know, also people, how people communicate, the whole proliferation of the understanding of non-binary people and understanding what's the best practices for them. Also that the way that people consume information is just different now. It's all social media, and we have to lean into it. We can't just, you know, so they're not going to read scientific journals, and, you know, so we need to make sure that the right information is getting out in a simple and understandable manner, so that people can make their own decisions on how they want to engage in their sexual activity.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more, Paddy. And getting the students to go out to local schools and do sex education, what a great project, what a great initiative. How did that go down? And what are some of the barriers? You know, I'm thinking you're down in the South, in Louisiana. That can't be easy at times for you or your students, given the political climate in the US.
Huge barriers. First of all, sexual health and sexual education is very disjointed, particularly in the South, but all over the United States, it's disjointed. In the Deep South, we have very, very conservative population, and they are very afraid of a lot of things. And they're afraid of us talking about sexual orientation and gender identity, or SOGI. They're very afraid of us, what they say, grooming their children for things. So what I do is I make sure that I send out all the material that we're using to the parents, so they can make, and it's an opt out. They opt out if they don't want it. And every once in a while, there are a few kids that whose parents have decided to opt out. And that's fine. That's their option. The kids are great. They love it. And they ask, and my students are wonderful too. Looking at me, who's like more like their mom or their grandma, and looking at a student that's, you know, 20 years old, they're going to listen to the 20-year-old better. So as long as I can give them the right information and show them, I think it'll be more successful. My hope is that we would get more standardized, but it's not going to happen. I had a principal last year call me up the night before we were supposed to give the talk and say, "Can you not talk about sex?" I'm like, "Well, that would be very difficult to not talk about sex when we're doing sexual education." And then finally she said, "Okay," but people are fearful. I mean, a lot of the administrators are afraid of the population because there's a very vocal minority that are really kind of challenging everything we do. Most parents, and we've done surveys, most parents want their kids to have sex ed in school, and most parents want it to be comprehensive. But it's the vocal minority that's kind of making the decisions for the population.
That very often tends to be the case, Paddy, doesn't it? When you've got the minority who make the noise, and people actually think the numbers are bigger than they are. And hopefully things will evolve, and some of the work that you're doing out in the field will change some of those mindsets. Just going back to your early work, and you know, you mentioned you'd spent 35 years in the field. What are the main changes over those 35 years that you've seen? Probably, you know, focusing on the US for better and for worse, just looking back over time.
So the pendulum swings back and forth and back and forth. In the beginning, where we didn't have very good information and whatnot, we were very much in a sort of behavioral mindset. Then all these great medications became available, and then we went into a biomedical. And I think we're biomedical. And STI, not different than HIV, is biomedical now. People are really interested in PrEP, Daxi PrEP for the... and so I think that there's going to be room for that. Also, you know, AMR was, you know, antimicrobial resistance was important, but it's gotten like critical now. Like if we ran out of drugs for syphilis here in the United States, that is a huge problem when something is so treatable and we don't have the right medication or we don't. It's tough to get these studies funded and it's tough for people to understand, you know, and so for a lot of my, and I've also seen the pendulum swing. In the 90s, we did a lot of work with expedited partner treatment. And expedited partner treatment, which is the provision of medication or a prescription to an index patient to deliver to their sexual partners. We found great evidence for it in some pockets, not all. You know, gay men, maybe not as much, but other pockets, we found it to be very effective, particularly in the field of chlamydia. Then we changed the medication for chlamydia. So now doxycycline, it has to be a multi-dose. You can't just give out doxycycline for EPT as easily because what if the partner is pregnant? If the person is pregnant, they shouldn't be taking doxycycline. So it's a little bit more complicated than it was 20 years ago. So that is some of the issues. You know, I didn't mention this. I did with a bunch taking Ralph DiClemente and Gina Wingood's ECLE. We modified that for online delivery, and it's a sexual health program, and we incentivized the kids to go through it, and it worked really well. We were able to prevent some STIs. It got no interest. I can't get anybody to get interested in either funding it for scalability or, I don't know. I think we're just in a biomedical mode right now, and people aren't just interested in these kinds of interventions. And I think it's short-sighted because something like that could be scaled up really readily, really, maybe not the incentive part because that was, you know, that can be expensive, but the intervention could be scaled up, but you have to have the funders interested in it. And so right now they're interested in biomedical stuff. They're not interested in that. And so that happens. It's cyclic. And let's hope that, you know, funding is limited. So we have to know that. And so we do have to prioritize for what are feasible interventions that can be used. And so I always bake in a cost effectiveness. In any randomized trial I do now, I always put cost effectiveness because it's so important to show that it will save you money in the long run. If it won't save you money, nobody's going to engage it in it.
So let's take a short break to bring you a message from one of our sponsors.
OraSure are the makers of OraQuick HIV self-test, which uses oral fluid to check for antibodies to HIV type 1 and HIV type 2, the viruses that cause AIDS. The kit is designed to allow you to take the HIV test anonymously and in private with the collection of an oral fluid sample by swabbing your upper and lower gums with the test device.
And it's interesting as well, we sort of talked about the silo between HIV and STIs that you'd sort of broken through. And from what I'm seeing, sort of being in the US now and having a bit more exposure, is that biomedical and the sociological as well. There tends to be a bit of a silo, whereas the two actually encroach and there's so many links between the two.
If you've ever seen the movie, what is it, Field of Dreams? If you build it, they will come. Not necessarily. You can have a beautiful intervention. I mean, DoxyPep didn't work in women. Is that a biomedical issue or is it a behavioral? The common idea, and Janelle Stewart will tell you, she thinks is adherence. So you need behavioralists to look at why won't they adhere? What is the underlying root cause? Because, you know, maybe they just don't see the interest, they don't have interest in it, they're afraid of it, you know. So we do need behavioralists. And I span that because being a nurse and understanding the clinical side, I also understand the behavioral side. So I think we need more people that can span both and understand that you can build beautiful biomedical interventions, but if nobody takes them, they're not going to work. And so that's going to be the case, unless, you know, we need behaviorals all along the way.
Couldn't agree more. And those linkages and trying to break down some of those artificial barriers that have been put up. You know, I was speaking to somebody and they were talking about prevention and testing, you know, and how they're different budgets and different blocks, and actually the links between the two. So doing remote testing, you put a condom into your kid, it counts as prevention. It counts as testing. You know, it's crazy when you think about it, when all the solutions are actually needed.
Yeah, we really need more and more complex interventions that cover multiple prongs of the problem. No, nothing in health now is, there's no magic bullet for anything in health. There's so many different things that, you know, they used to give out vitamin A and thought that would cure everybody. Well, we know you can't. You have to look at it comprehensively, holistically, with multidisciplinary approach.
Absolutely. And tell me, you mentioned sort of the engagement of young people, Paddy, and social media and the importance of communication. In terms of the students that are engaging in the programs, are you seeing a difference in motivation or changes over the years that you've been working at Tulane?
One thing I want to say, as far as my students who are conducting the STI trainings, they are much more open-minded than I think my generation was. They use different words than I would use, and they, they use a different terminology. So I'm really thankful for that. As far as the subjects themselves, like the African American kids that I worked with, had never been asked to be on a study. This is like the first time that anybody sort of approached them on the topic, and they're like, STIs? All they knew is HIV. Some of them might have known chlamydia, but they don't know any other STIs, and they don't know much about it. And, you know, they get very random and sort of disjointed information. A lot of it's from social media. Another thing is, you know, we have to deal with things that we didn't deal with before, like sexting and the proliferation of pornography, which sets up an unrealistic expectation for the young people, and they're afraid. They're like, I can't do that. What they're doing on pornography, I can't do that. So some of them are opting to just not have sex. And so I think that's a sad thing, because I think, you know, understand that, you know, sex is for fun. It's for pleasure. Some people, it's for procreation, but it should have a component that of intimacy and understanding. And I think that with the Tinder population and the pornography, we're losing that. And I think we need to get back to that. So I think interventions that can help people to understand relationships, even though it's not STI specifically, this might have a great impact on STIs.
Absolutely. No, it's so interesting. I saw a survey a few months ago in France, and it was 70% of adolescents said that they got their sex education through pornography.
And you know, in pornography, they're not using condoms. I mean, some of them, it's very rare. I don't know. I haven't done an assessment. I don't think my firewall will let me go on, or my husband. But the thing is, you know, they're not getting the sex ed. You know, they don't even know where their the women don't even know where their cervix is. I mean, how can you protect yourself if you don't even know what it is? So I think it's really kind of negligent on our part, on society's part, to not train these children in a very human thing to do. Having sex is very human. And so why, you know, it's also just a lot of that hyper religiosity and ultra conservatism that says, if you talk about sex ed, then they're going to have more sex. Well, guess what? They're already having sex. So you better talk to them about it, or you're going to have a pregnancy. And in most of the southern states of the United States, abortion is now becoming illegal. So it's a double whammy if a kid gets pregnant and then they have an STI, and let's say they get HIV, and, you know, they're very much going to have trouble. And the system doesn't have a lot of resources for.
And you said when we were talking about the schools and the outreach, that a number of your students had stayed in the sexual health field, which is great to hear. What were you seeing as the motivations for them in terms of staying?
Yeah, some of them just love researching because I want to know the answer to stuff. And I know that it's a quest. So you answer one question, you open up 10 more. And some people like that and some people don't. So these three or four students did like it. And one of them specifically loved doing the sex ed. And so she's working in sex ed. One of them specifically loved the research. So now she's in research. You know, one's at Yale, one's at George Washington. You know, and some of them, while they appreciated it, it's just not, they were wanting to go into medical school or whatever. But specifically in STI research, we need more young people. We need refreshment. We need new points of view. Getting younger people or newer investigators involved will have a different viewpoint and a different approach that might be more relevant to the young. STIs is mostly a young person's disease. There are some elderly people that are getting it, but it's usually a young person's disease. So we need to understand the perspective of the young people and what you have to pivot. Like, I was deeply into expedited partner treatment. And now that there's so many issues with AMR, you know, I'm pivoting to other things because that was a good approach at the time. And it might be a good approach in the future. But for right now, the uptake has not been what we thought it would be. It's a problem to get people to pay for it. We can't get insurance companies to pay for it because unless the partners are on the same insurance as the index, they're not going to do it. And so you have to be open-minded and pivot to the changes of what are happening in the field.
Well, let's have this conversation, Patty, in, let's say, 5 years' time or 10 years' time. What would you hope would have changed in the sort of STI field in the US? What are the main blockers for you? Or from a positive side, you know, what would you like to see developing further that is good and positive in the field?
Developing further, I would love to see the merging of HIV and STIs. HIV is an STI. They are the same thing. Why did we silo that out? Why did we do that? And HIV people are getting STDs left and right now because of PrEP. And, you know, how do you get that funded? So we need to not silo that. We also need to have our patients involved more in the development of interventions. The more we can have the population involved, the better these interventions are going to work and the uptake is going to be much more acceptable to them. So making sure that. I also think that there's going to have to be more interest in getting us out of this AMR issue, antimicrobial resistance, because it is such a problem. I think that the players, more industry is going to have to work more with researchers and NIH to get more of these medications out that are more effective. And, you know, why can't we get people to use condoms? It's the simplest, cheapest prevention, but we can't get people to use condoms. So it's an age-old problem. So now, I mean, how can we do that? So it's refining and it's making people understand sex positivity, being much more sex positive, being much more open to non-binary genders, being much more open to multi-pronged interventions that might look a little odd, like promoting good relationships might have STI outcomes. And so, I mean, I think being open to those kinds of more non-traditional interventions, everybody loves biomedical because you give them a pill and it's done, but it doesn't always work like that in STIs because you've got a sexual network you're dealing with. You're not dealing with just one person. You're dealing with the sexual network.
Something else as you were talking that came to mind was just the whole sort of implementation science piece as well. So the research that you're doing, how do you and Tulane work with public health agencies? You mentioned obviously the research that you were doing on TV, but do you work locally as well with the local public health jurisdictions? How does that sort of relationship work between academia and public health?
The most fun part of the job is we have 50 partners in the community. And these are people that own like po' boy shops or snowball stands. And they are the people that the population is going to listen to. So we cull our relationship with them and we make sure that, you know, we listen to them and they tell us this is where people are going. This is what they want to do. This is what they want to hear. And, you know, also they're kind of just a neglected population. People haven't really been listening to the community. Some groups are really good at that. But I would say it's not often done. A lot of it is top down. And I think that that's just not a good approach. We need some top down because not everybody in the community can understand like the basic science of it. But we can make it understandable to them through common, clear wording. And so making sure that the population is is involved. And yeah, just loving, you got to have partners, you have to have community advisory boards, and you know, you have to get sometimes people that don't agree with you, and you have to go with what, you know, listen and understand their perspective. I don't think we do enough of that these days. We're tribal and we listen to what we think and we look for things that support our narrative. Listening to the other side sometimes is good because you understand why they think like that. You know, we were going out in the community and testing, and I kept hearing, wow, it's getting that bad. It's getting that bad. Like they didn't know it was that bad. And it is that bad because we've got really high rates of STIs. So just seeing that the population, like just being there and answering their questions. And you know, the whole system doesn't support that. You work and work and work. You get a grant, you do it, and then you publish the paper, and then you're on to the next thing. So you don't have time to cull and really simmer on what you found and disseminate what you found. And so I wish that that would also be part of it. Like maybe grants shouldn't be 5 years. They should be 6 years. So you get a sixth year to disseminate the information.
Cascade it down and see how it's working in the field.
Right.
Yep. No. Very, very interesting. And in terms of those community partners, who are the kinds of people that you're working with? You mentioned the 50 partners. Is it not-for-profits, community-based organizations?
Some of them are shop owners. And, you know, like I have hired bartenders to go out and help me with some research because bartenders are really good at talking to people and they really get people going. I think that, you know, a lot of them are just like, there's one guy that has the Stop Jockin'. It's like a snowball stand, a po' boy stand, a place where people can go and meet. And this is a place that we just decided to do like a band, like a battle of the bands there. And it was so fun. And it was so great. And we didn't get that many people testing, but we got people to think about it. So then when we came back weeks later, then they wanted to get tested. So, it, you know, a lot of them are just, they're just people that are interfacing with the community and they're part of the community. And they use different, you know, they don't speak the same way I might speak. So I need to understand how they talk and how they think.
Final question, Patty. If one of your students or an adolescent in a school that you're doing an outreach to came and said, I'm considering a career in sexual health, should I? And what would you recommend? What would your answer be?
I would say absolutely. It is one of the most satisfying things you can do. It is the intersection of health disparities, infectious disease, which I love, and research. And so it's just like really, really fun to do it. It's challenging. I would say that it is, to co-opt the Peace Corps, it's the toughest job you'll ever love because it is really fun to do it. And you can feel satisfied that you're really helping some people to maintain their health.
Thank you very much for listening to the Sticks and Stones podcast today. If you do have a moment to rate and review us, it really does help other people to find this content. And remember, you can also follow us on Twitter under Sticks STI. That's Sticks STIIX STI. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.